Bobsky.
20 seconds, stand by.
20 seconds. What are we going to do?
Access news, show pages, archives, content.
I hope nobody's listening. I'm nervous.
Interactive chat room. Set show notifications.
Did you tweet to them already?
Miss your fit.
All right, here we go. Six. Five. Four.
Do you?
Two. One. We're live.
Hobbs, you're going to have to do your own dirty work now. Do you hear me? Do you?
Is the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grailian Bunker, welcome one and all once again to your weekly hub for the esoteric and the unusual. It is the Grailian Report. I'm glad, as always, to be your host, Micah Hanks, your doctor here in the dark heart of the hollow earth, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe by KGRARadio.com, a very mythic location here on the darkest corner of the interwebs. Joining me in studio, as always, the guy around whom it is never dark because of the illumination emanating from his eyeballs, Mr. Matthew the Reverend Oakley. Good evening to you, sir.
Good evening to you as well.
Glad to have you here, as always. Ladies and gentlemen, boy, have we got an action-packed program for you tonight. We're going to be looking at what's going on further south, sending thoughts, prayers, and good vibes to everybody who's being affected by Hurricane Harvey. A little more on that in a moment. And, of course, later on in hour two, I'm going to tell you one of the most unusual legends I've ever come across. It's not really a legend. This seems to actually be a verified incident, although there perhaps is an element of urban myth that was built onto it. What does this have to do with strange, ghost-like entities in Malay cultures and wild men reports right here in North America? Well, you'll find out all about that during hour two. Quite a story to tell, and some actual wild man reports from a part of the country I plan to head to fairly soon. Right now, I want you guys to head over to Gaia.com/Grailian. Check out what they have to offer, some of the hand-selected programs from our sponsors. Gaia.com/Grailian. A little more on that shortly as well. But of course, before we really get things going, it wouldn't be a program, would it, if it weren't for our producer back in Master Control, back at his home, his Southern Command in Fort Smith, Arkansas, Race Hobbo Hobbs.
Hobbit Hole.
Yes, the Hobbit Hole. How you doing, Hobbo?
I'm doing wonderful, gentlemen. How are y'all?
We're just dandy as daisies.
Swell.
Swell indeed.
The Hobbit Hole. Hobbo, Hobbo.
Yes, that's right. It's not the kind of a hole where you find the oozy ends of worms. No, it is a fortified bunker. You know, if you're going to be in this business, you might as well have your own bunker. And Matt, I hear, is attempting to try and find one of his own right now.
I am. It's a long, arduous search. A journey, if you will. But I'm making progress.
He's making progress. Because, you know, after a while, the little bird has to leave the nest, and this bunker isn't going to be good enough for him anymore. Got to go find his own bunker. What can you do? What can you do? So, Race, speaking of going out and finding things in the world, you have spent a lot of time on the road lately. Where in the world have you been? No, actually, the question is, where in the world haven't you been recently?
Well, you know, the solar eclipse was something that I think we all should see. And big group of us here at KGRA decided to bone out and go up to Kentucky. We went to Franklin County, Kentucky, to go see the eclipse. And just so happens there in Franklin County is the very haunted museum called the Octagon Hall. And so we made a combination trip out of it. I guess you could say we killed two birds with one stone. We went there and did an investigation at the hall for KGRA TV and KGRA Investigations. And then we all sort of got to hang out with all the crazies and the scientists and the whole, I mean, I'm telling you guys, there was 40,000 people within eye shot in both directions, up and down the strip. And there were so many people of all walks of life there to see this. But photographs, videos do this eclipse no justice. To see it with your own eyes was absolutely, for me, it was a God thing. It was literally just a heavenly thing to be a part of. And so we were blessed to get to go do that. And then while there, a couple of us were talking, and one of the owners of KGRA, Warren Brager, said he had never been this far south before, and he had always wanted to go see Louisiana. And before you know it, we've sketched out another plan to tear out when we were done there in Kentucky, and head south to New Orleans, or New Orleans. So that kind of gave birth to a plan to go down there, and we literally drove back to Arkansas, did a load of laundry, spent the night, and then left and went to New Orleans. By way of Natchez, Mississippi, we stayed at a beautiful bed and breakfast there on the river up on the bluff in Natchez. That's just another wonderful stop in the South that I think everybody should make. And then got up the next morning after breakfast and drove into New Orleans and had a wonderful time there. And then all the way back, guys, 2,500 miles I drove in under 2 weeks. And it was absolutely a wonderful adventure. But I have to say, I'm glad to be back here at Studio 1A with you guys tonight. I've missed you greatly.
The Hobo Tour 2017, ladies and gentlemen, on the road and coming to a town near you. Well, I hope you guys make your way this way, or at very least, maybe I can join you on the next adventure.
Well, the next adventure's going west. We're going to be in Salt Lake City, Utah, this one will be October the 7th. Robin and I are taking our vacation to Utah, and at the same time, the KGRA is going to be covering a conference down there, or over there, I should say. So the big guy gets around, you know. It's an amazing thing to see.
You're traveling at least as much as I am these days. And again, if I get a chance to come out there on the road with you, you know, we always have Matt who can stay at the main control room in his new bunker.
I was wondering why you were leaving me out.
Yeah, because you can stay behind once you have your new bunker.
I don't want to stay behind.
Well, if you're getting your own bunker, though, I presume that's why you're doing this, is so that you can lay back and you can man the console for us when Race and I are out there adventuring. Yeah, we need one of the guys, you know, to stay at, you know, home base and keep an eye on things, Matt.
I'll just follow you around in my own car.
You can follow me on Twitter. How's that?
Not good enough. Not good enough.
And Facebook, Instagram.
That's right. Oh, you know, Instagram just blew up after we had Tiffany on the show last week.
Instagram's been big for a while. It's not just because you were on it.
No, I'm saying my Instagram was blowing up after last week's show. Yeah, but, you know, speaking of the eclipse, too, Jaina McKeeman, the Earth nerd, she writes to us from time to time, good friend, a little out further out west, and she and her science buddies sent along some of the best photographs. They had created their own mobile eclipse tracking station, and some of the photos they got of the eclipse were just bar none the best that I've seen. And I was so impressed by what they did, I finally broke down and bought a new piece of equipment for us to use at our own Graylian Observatory. I actually finally got one of these USB camera mounts that will fit into the lens of the telescope, and then you can use that to transmit video to your laptop and record it, and actually utilize the laptop screen as a monitor for what you're viewing through the telescope. So really, really excited about that. And they were using one of these with an eclipse telescope to be able to get some really great photographs. So thanks, Jaina. You inspired me to upgrade our equipment set here at the Graylian Studios. Now, speaking of what's going on lately as far as natural occurrences, a little further south, we have, of course, had Hurricane Harvey, which sent devastating floods pouring into the nation's fourth largest city on Sunday. As rising water chased thousands of people to rooftops or higher ground and overwhelmed rescuers who could not keep up with the constant calls for help. And let me tell you, folks, there were a lot of them. I mean, a lot. The incessant rain covered much of Houston in turbid gray-green water, according to an AP report, and turned streets into rivers navigable only by boat. In a rescue effort that recalled the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, helicopters landed near flooded freeways, airboats buzzed across submerged neighborhoods, and high-water vehicles plowed through waterlogged intersections. Some people managed with kayaks or canoes. Others had to swim. Now, volunteers joined emergency teams to pull people from their homes or from the water, which was high enough, they say, in places to gush into second floors. I have seen footage online of people catching fish in their living rooms. All kinds of things like this. The flooding from Harvey, which made landfall late on Friday as a Category 4 hurricane, was so widespread that authorities had trouble pinpointing what the worst areas actually were. I was just checking with a bunch of our friends down south, including new KGRA. Can we announce this, by the way, Race? The latest additions? Is it too soon?
No, no better person to announce it than yourself, Micah.
That's right. The latest additions to the KGRA family, our good pals Cam and Kyle from Expanded Perspectives. Yep. Newly added to the roster here at KGRA, so look out for them in the coming days. But anywho, I mean, they're right down there in the heart of Texas, so I was messaging Kyle just this morning and trying to make sure what was going on down there and that they were taken care of. My good pal Blair Bressler, of course, Blair and Brian, dear friends of mine, they're okay. Blair says in true Texas style, we're holed up, we've got generators, we got guns, we got food, we got water, we're okay. She says, I'm worried about everybody else who's lost property and things like this. Now, again, as we know right now, the Army Corps of Engineers early on Monday started the water releases as the reservoirs ahead of schedule after water levels increased dramatically in just a few hours' time. This, according to a spokesman this morning, officials had warned residents that they should pack their cars Sunday night and wait for daylight today to leave. A lot of them did. Probably there are a lot of people still there. And judging from federal disaster declarations, the storm has so far affected about a quarter of the Texas population. All the more reason I'm checking in with everybody I know down there. I want to hear from you, by the way, and we're going to give out information on how you can contact the program tonight, because if you're in one of the affected areas, we'd love to be able to get a report from you. More on that in a moment. But again, you know, as the water rose, the National Weather Service chimed in also. They issued another ominous forecast. They said that before the storm that arrived Friday as a Category 4 hurricane is gone, they say some parts of Houston and its suburbs could still get as much as 50 inches of rain. And that would be the highest amount ever recorded in the Lone Star State. Some areas have already received about half that amount as it is. And since Thursday, they say South Houston recorded nearly 25 inches and the suburbs of Santa Fe and Dayton got 27. Now, the breadth and intensity of the rainfall is beyond anything experienced before, the National Weather Service said in their statement. Of course, the average rainfall totals will end up being around 40 inches for Houston. And they say Weather Service meteorologist in the area, and actually the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Brock Long, they predicted that the aftermath of the storm would require FEMA's involvement perhaps for years to come. So a lot of agencies are really looking ahead. This disaster is going to be probably a landmark event, according to Mr. Long. And rescuers had to give top priority to life and death situations, leaving many affected families to fend for themselves in several hospitals there in the Houston area, which were already being evacuated due to the rising waters. And that's always problematic. Again, you know, I put this out to you guys. If you're in Texas or one of the affected areas down there in the Gulf, we have a hurricane update line. I'd like to hear from you either tonight or throughout the week for those who download the podcast later. That number is 828-367-7201. Don't call. We would prefer if you would text us. So send us, you know, a short message via text at that number, 828-367-7201. Let us know how you're doing down there. We hope you guys are okay. And of course, you know, if you're in trouble, before you text us, get in touch with local authorities or the proper agencies as needed. Make sure that you can find your way to a shelter. Look out for your neighbors. Make sure that you guys all stick together and take care of one another down there. You know, there's a photograph, Matt, that went viral over the last few days of a dog. And this guy accidentally got loose Friday night during the hurricane and ended up becoming an unlikely symbol of Texas strength after the photos went viral. Now, you see, Otis is a German Shepherd mix, and he got loose Friday night from a screened back porch in Sinton, Texas, while in the care of Salvador Segovia. Segovia was watching the dog, who belongs to his 5-year-old grandson, Carter, who had had to flee the city with his family due to the flooding. When Segovia went to check in on the dog on Friday night, he found that he was gone. He said, I kept yelling his name, and he wasn't around. Well, Segovia checked his back porch again on Saturday morning and noticed that Otis's bag of food was now missing. So Segovia drives around his neighborhood looking for the pooch, when he was flagged down by a neighbor who said that they saw Otis walking around and he was carrying his bag of food around with him, visiting everybody during the storm. That's right. Fellow neighbor Teal Dawkins also saw Otis and snapped a photo of him with his food that went viral. And there's the pooch walking along, carrying his bag of food and still making the rounds, visiting everybody in the neighborhood. Apparently, this image of Otis has now been shared nearly 16,000 times as of around 5 o'clock on Saturday. They say, we're a population of 6,000. We were out today clearing tree limbs from streets. Families are already getting cleaned up and straightening up their properties. The town is still out of water and power, but I was driving around checking on families, friends, and properties and that decided to evacuate when they, of course, saw Otis. He decided to hang around and check in on everybody. Isn't that cute? It's always good to hear from the animal kindred, the four-legged friends out there.
Yeah, that's definitely an up story, you know, in the midst of all the chaos and everything. I actually spoke to someone, a acquaintance of a colleague of mine, earlier today, who said he is flooded in on the second floor, as you had mentioned earlier, of his apartment building. Literally no water in his apartment, but the power's out, and he walks out in the hallway, looks down the stairs, and he can't go down the stairs because the water has risen so high.
Wow. Yeah, well, again, we do hope to hear from everybody out there. If you're in one of the affected areas, one more time, that number to text. This is the official Graylian Hurricane Update text line. It's 828-367-7201. We'll be checking that throughout the breaks and periodically throughout the show tonight. Again, our hearts and our cosmic love is being sent out to you guys out there, and we hope that you guys can pull together and get through it. We know you will. You're tough. And right now, we need people to be tough and be conscientious and be thinking about others. Getting into a little of the science news going on right now, astrophysicists say that they may have detected gravitational waves last week, but not the kind that we are used to hearing about now. They say that these may have emanated from the collision of two neutron stars in a distant galaxy. And telescopes trained on the same region might also have spotted this event. Now, rumors to that effect, at least, are already spreading online. You know, it's hard for people to keep secrets these days. And although many researchers are excited about this, there's been a little controversy about it, too, because, well, somebody spilled the beans, maybe a little too soon. You see, such a detection as this could mark a new era of astronomy, one in which phenomena are both seen by conventional telescopes, but then also heard as vibrations in the fabric of space-time. And according to Stuart Shapiro, an astrophysicist at the University of Illinois, it would be an incredible advance in our understanding. Basically, a capability unlike anything we've seen, where we can kind of triangulate these signals utilizing multiple different detection systems. Now, scientists who work with gravitational wave detectors won't comment on the gossip right now because they say the data is still under analysis. Public records show that telescopes around the world have been looking in the same area, in fact, at this same galaxy, at least since last week. But astronomers caution that they could have been picking up signals from an unrelated source. Now, our good friends at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory down in Louisiana and in Washington State, they have now said that three times they have detected gravitational waves, these ripples that we were referring to in the fabric of space-time, and they do believe that these emerge from colliding black holes. But scientists have been hoping to detect ripples from another cosmic cataclysm, such as the merger of neutron stars, remnants of large stars that exploded but were not massive enough to collapse into a black hole, this reported by Nature. And they say that such an event should also emit radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum from radio waves to Y-rays, which telescopes might still be able to pick up. But now here's where things get a little weird. We're still trying to figure out where we got this information from. So on August 18th, there's an astronomer named J. Craig Wheeler. He's with the University of Texas at Austin. And apparently he tweeted something. See, these days you learn about everything, whether it's leaks from the White House or leaks from the scientific establishment, when somebody tweets about it. And so Wheeler tweeted that, quote, new LIGO, source with optical counterpart, blow your socks off. That's what he said. An hour later, astronomer Peter Joachim of the University of Washington in Seattle tweeted that LIGO had seen a signal with an optical counterpart. That is something with telescopes that are able to view it. And this from a galaxy called NGC 4993. That's about 40 million parsecs away. For those who aren't in the know, by the way, bringing that down to layman's terms, 130 million light years. But you guys knew that, right? Yeah. And this all emanating from the southern constellation known as Hydra. Now, merging neutron star is the initial call, was another one of the follow-up tweets. And some astronomers who didn't want to be identified are already saying that the rumors had been privately circulating before Wheeler and Joachim's tweets. Again, just goes to show you learn everything from tweets these days. I got an update, though, about this, by the way, because Wheeler and Joachim, they've been kind of mum about this since then. In fact, actually, I think it was Wheeler who actually tweeted this. He said, right or wrong, I should not have sent that tweet. LIGO deserves to announce when they deem appropriate, so mea culpa. So he admits that he maybe got a little ahead of himself when he did this. But the LIGO and Virgo collaboration, apparently, as of August 27th, they posted a top-level update, and this is what that update was. They say now that some promising gravitational wave candidates have been identified in data from both LIGO and Virgo during the preliminary analysis, and we have shared what we currently know with astronomical observing partners. They further say that we are working hard to assure that the candidates are valid gravitational wave events, and it will require time to establish the level of confidence needed to bring any results to the scientific community and greater public. So we will let you know as soon as we have information ready to share. And in the meantime, we're going to advise our astronomers not to be active on Twitter.
This is an enthralling story. I was reading a bit about it earlier, and even some NASA astrophysicists have weighed in, saying that, you know, after decades of speculation and theorizing that these GRBs, I believe is the anagram, right? Or
was it GRBs? Or was it F, gravitational? Well, I think you're thinking of FRBs, fast radio bursts.
I can pull it up here, but they said after decades of theorizing about this kind of stuff, that they are associated with neutron star collisions. Only gravitational waves could give us the smoking gun that we've been looking for. And because, as you briefly mentioned, touched on, that these are emitted by black hole collisions, but these, what happens is that it typically only lasts a second or less, but these neutron star collisions can last up to a minute or more. So it allows so much more time and so much more ability to gain that smoking gun, you know, data.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it takes a little time sometimes to get around to it, but once you do, I mean, it all makes sense, right?
And it is GRBs, short Y-ray bursts.
Ah, there you go. See, they need to diversify their acronyms just a little, because it's getting hard to keep up with all these things. Okay, I want to talk about something even more mysterious, but similarly celestial. Here, as we're getting to our news segment, or actually getting close to ending it, but apparently there was something interesting that was observed, which we haven't seen in a long time in our skies. And no, it wasn't that eclipse. Yeah, that's right. For the first time, scientists have predicted the activity of a comet, and this based on observations of its trailing meteoroids. And in doing so, they may have solved the mystery of how a meteor shower called the Phoenicians was barely seen from Earth for almost 60 years. Now, Science Alert reports that unlike some of the particularly famous annual meteor showers enjoyed by stargazers across the globe, the Phoenicians were discovered as what they describe as a spectacular meteor swarm that rained down, but only one time, back in 1956. And then for decades after that, we didn't see anything. That was, of course, until 2014, when a team of researchers from the Graduate University of Advanced Studies in Japan, including one of the veterans who had been back there in 1956 and had seen these things coming down, they got together and they managed again to witness the Phoenician light show, thanks to astronomical data going back as far as the 1800s. Now, the long story short is that, again, they've been able to account for this, and now they think that they have new data about a comet. This comet, which is called, 289P Blancpain. It was first discovered way back in 1819 before it, too, seemingly vanished from human eyes until a discovery almost two centuries later showed what might have happened to this lost comet. And now they are kind of extrapolating data from both. This indicates, they say, that the parent body of Phoenicians was still active as a comet in the early 20th century and provided meteoroids, although its activity level was significantly weaker than at the beginning of the 19th century. And what we're now seeing, they say, is kind of the last hurrah of this soon-to-be ghost comet, as they say it arcs through the void of space. But this is interesting to me because, again, I've been digging very deeply over the weekend into possible causes behind the Younger Dryas. The Younger Dryas being a climate event that occurred about 13,000 years ago, coming out of the last ice age. And we saw about 1,300 years of really significant temperature drops, at least in northern hemispheres. We actually had little to no change along the equator, and then actually further south, especially around Antarctica, we had temperature rise. So it was in kind of an inverse relationship in terms of the climate model going on back then. Why is all this important? Well, because as we've reported on this program, there was a article that was published by Nature, or in the journal Nature, rather. Some of the co-authors, including Dr. Albert Goodyear, are friends of the program. You know, I know Al pretty good, and we've spent a lot of time down there with him at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. More in relation to our archaeological interests, but you got to keep in mind that archaeology is one finger on the glove, and the whole hand is the question of what happened in our ancient past, and the Younger Dryas seems to be a significant aspect to all this. Matt, we've talked about it an awful lot.
Absolutely.
One of the most significant climate events that has happened, and many would even refer to it, even though it's, again, 13,000 years or so ago that this happened, this is by many climatologists, geologists, and other researchers referred to as, you know, pretty much the go-to model of abrupt climate change. And the new Nature article that Albert Goodyear, Chris Moore, Alan West, and a number of others co-authored presents probably, I would say, the best evidence we've seen thus far that there was an impact that occurred in Paleo-Indian times, that the impact likely struck North America, and that the best evidence for this is multiple readings of platinum, anomalous levels of platinum in certain strata. We found this both in terms of actual stratigraphy here on the North American continent, but also from ice cores in Greenland. And so we have multiple different areas where this data seems to reflect that there is a rare earth element. And again, for platinum or iridium or something like that to be present in large quantities, typically what you have to have is an extraterrestrial source because of its rareness here on Earth. And the easiest explanation for that extraterrestrial source is a meteorite or an asteroid impact. And some have further supposed that when we look at that event, that in more recent times there may have been smaller scale but related events, like what was known as the Tunguska blast of 1908, a very strange, mysterious explosion, where something obviously coming from space seems to have exploded over the Siberian tundra, and it caused widespread damage. Fortunately, that was over a very remote area. What happens if something like that happens over a city, or at very least a more populated area? I mean, it really could be doomsday, as we would define it in modern times, or in any time. And so the question is, by studying these patterns in celestial phenomena, meteors and things like this, the coming and going of comets and meteoroids that may follow in their tail, can we learn to predict future cataclysms? That's a very important point, and I think it's one that is fundamental to our interest in these things. When we talk about this stuff on the Graylian Report, it's not often like what you see in films like Armageddon. The science often may not be as flashy and as romantic and interesting, but it's far more important, especially as it relates to the future survival of humanity as a species. And guys, you know, we've got to really educate ourselves on these things. So I'm not trying to be a doom speaker, but I definitely advocate being informed on the possibilities, and that's one that we definitely need to be mindful of. Okay, we're almost up on a break. Before we head out to pay the bills, I do need to tell you guys about what's happening right now with our friends over at Gaia.com. And this week, actually, there's something really interesting that they're talking about. Matt, I remember the first time that I saw the Matrix films. Mm-hmm. The first time my girlfriend in high school brought over the first Matrix movie. And I remember I watched it and I wasn't sure what this movie was about. And I'm like, okay, great. Yeah, this is not really captivating me or anything. You know, the whole Neo, he's a hacker. He goes to nightclubs and stuff. All of a sudden, he takes a pill and he wakes up and it's like full-blown alien abduction. And I remember getting almost physically like sick to my stomach as I watched it. I keep in mind, I was still a teenager, okay? I was young and tender at
apparently.
At that young age. I remember watching it, and the reason I say this is because, I mean, the narrative of the film shifted so starkly and so quickly, and it really caught me off guard, and it very quickly in that moment became one of my favorite films. And many people, also I would say those of a mystical mindset, seem to share this fondness for those films like I do. And I've never forgotten that viewing experience of just thinking, okay, another humdrum movie about a guy, and then it just goes, whoa, alternate reality, artificial intelligence, I mean, avatars in a simulated reality. I mean, a lot of this stuff had a profound influence on my outlook on life, and I know many of us feel that way. And on the new show, Hollywood Decoded, with Jay Dyer and Jay Widener, the two J's, the hosts this week are going straight for everybody's favorite film series. That's right, you guessed it. Dealing with alternate realities, AI, mythic symbolism, and holographic universes. The Matrix trilogy, so you don't want to miss that. Get a breakdown on the symbolism that appears in those films. I know I enjoyed that an awful lot. And of course, I should also mention our good pal George Norrie with his Beyond Belief is going to be interviewing a very special guest, Major Ed Danes, who's going to be talking about remote viewing and how it's been used by military over the years. While I was up in Nova Scotia, you know, we did a panel discussion, Paul Kimball, Greg Bishop, and I, on remote viewing. That's truly a fascinating subject to me. And, hey, new series alert. There's a brand new show called Steps to the Future that Gaia offers also, where viewers are treated to a cutting-edge series that brings new light to the most compelling topics. You're going to hear about communication with other worlds, or whether gamma rays or supervolcanoes or magnetic pole reversals might destroy the Earth. Again, we're getting a little catastrophist here tonight on the program, but you'll be able to examine these new theories based on unique individuals and discover how close we are to unlocking the secrets of the Fountain of Youth. Is that a literal place that you can find? Probably not. But will medical science teach us things about longevity and the human lifespan in the years to come that will really fundamentally change how we live? You can almost bet on it. So check out all of that over at Gaia.com/Graylian. That is, again, GAIA.com/Graylian. The proud sponsors of this program, friends of ours, and of course, we hope you guys will check them out as well. Now, when we come back from this break, we've got so much to get into right now, but I do want to spend a little time talking about this weird chemical scare that happened over there in London. And I want to also talk about the history of similar events that have occurred over there in the British Isles. There may be a little more to this than you have heard already or than you already think. It is the Graylian Report. We'll tackle that when we come back right after this.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Fade to Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
The dark hills of Appalachia. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Keeping you company as always. And boy, do I mean keeping you company. Trying to focus on all of the news over here. And I'm sure nobody's sitting out there in the comfort of their home listening to the program with the Weather Channel on mute, secretly sending messages to the mouth of the South. I know that never happens ever while I'm live on the air. Ever. Ah, that's right. A magician's work is never done. I'm a magician, by the way. Glad, as always, also to be your light in the darkness every Monday night. And joined, of course, by the Graylian Reverend as we try to make sense of the madness. Now, here in a moment, we're going to look at the madness that has been besetting many in the, not the Emerald Isle, but close to it. The British Isles, London, specifically. And there's a history of that. But first, I do have to tell you about something. Well, this is, I think, important to a lot of us, and it has to do with the guys out there, the fellas in the audience. I need to take a moment to address this very important issue with all the gentlemen right now. First, a question. How many of you guys out there love shopping for clothes? Yeah, not the kind of thing that usually us guys love to have to acknowledge, right? How much we love shopping for clothes. I'm kidding. I personally don't mind it that much. My biggest problem is just finding the time to go and get new wardrobe. I've got this crypto conference that I'm going to here in a couple of weeks. You know, Tiffany's already coordinating what she's going to wear and sending pictures. Check out this blouse. What do you think about these jeans? And I'm like, great. I've got to color coordinate now. Guys weren't meant to have to do this kind of thing, Matt. And for a lot of us guys, I know it's not just the time that you have to spend to go out and do it. No, going and trying on clothes and trying to find the right sizes can frankly just be a pain in the neck. And that's why I decided to try Bombfell. Now, Bombfell, simply put, is an easier way for guys like you and me to get better clothes. And once you sign up, you pay nothing. How's that work? Well, here's why. Because there are no fees to work with them. You only pay for the clothes that you decide to keep. And part of the reason I decided to go with Bombfell is they're the only service out there that can make that claim. Now, everything that you're sent by Bombfell is fully personalized. They handpick it for you. You have your own stylist who will email you with his or her selections, after which you'll have 48 hours to make any changes, and that's even before you are sent anything. You can even cancel altogether. You're in total control. But hands down, this is the most simple, straightforward service around. They don't make money if you don't find something that you want to keep. And of course, you can receive clothes from Bombfell once a month or every 2 months or every 3 months. So it's really up to you how often they send stuff, and you can pause it or you can cancel at any time. It's not hard to do. But look, signing up and getting your first shipment is really easy. Here is all you have to do. I'm going to tell you this in four easy steps because a lot of people, I think, they're as averse to having to go through a sign-up process as they are to having to go out to the store and find this stuff for themselves. Trust me, this is much easier. It's going to make your life much better. And this is all you have to do. Number one, you sign up. You tell them a little about yourself. You can include your measurements, your style preferences. You can even let them know what kind of budget you're most comfortable working with. Number two, you just let the folks at Bombfill know what you want to see in your next order. You know, if button-down shirts are your thing, if you like t-shirts, you want a new pair of jeans, you can select to have them send whatever you like in your size. They'll even send you socks. Seriously. And that's all with the assistance of giving to your personal stylist. Now, step three, your stylist is going to put together a selection and send you an email allowing you to preview what's about to be sent. Again, you can cancel that or change it if you don't like it. And then there's the fourth step, and this is the easiest one. You get your package, and you have 7 days to try on what they've sent. If you like it, you pay for it then and only then. What you don't like, you can actually return it. You've got 7 days. They'll cover the shipping for you. It's free both ways, coming to you or going out. So if you don't like it, you don't spend anything. Now, look, I'm not going to lie. I was actually really excited to see what my stylist, Lauren, was going to be sending. And the jeans she picked out fit me perfectly. I mean, come on, guys. It makes you wish everything you went shopping for fit that well. And again, though, I guess that's what part of what makes Bombfell so special. And while Bombfell provides clothes for the guys, I've got to point out that the ladies in the audience can sign up on behalf of their partner. Now, look, admit it. You know, he hates shopping for clothes, and now you can get some help picking out his wardrobe. And with the help of a personal stylist. So it's kind of like having a personal shopping buddy that's going to help you shop for him. Yeah, pure bliss. Now, I got my shipment in no time, and I know you're going to love what Bombfell will pick out for you. But here's the kicker. And since they wanted to work with the Graylian Report, listeners of this show can get $25 off their first purchase when they sign up. And here's how you do it. You just go over to bombfell.com/TGR. Let me spell that for you. It's bombfell.com/TGR. As in the Graylian Report, bombfell.com/TGR. Guys, this is not only going to make your lives easier, but it's the simplest way to update your wardrobe with real style, period. So head over right now to bombfell.com/TGR. It's Bombfell, open and clothes. So anyway, right now in London, there's something very strange going on. And Matt actually brought this story to my attention a little earlier today. We have this mysterious chemical haze. It's been reported that left scores of people on the English coast with streaming eyes, sore throats. Some people said that they had breathing problems. And although it seems to have dissipated, its cause remains a mystery, according to police and emergency services. Have you heard anything else? I've actually got one update as to what this might have been, Matt.
The only things I've really heard are testimonials of people there. I mean, this thing drove people off beaches, away from, you know, nice public areas where people are, I guess, vacationing. They even sent boats out into the ocean to get people out of the ocean and take them away to safe spaces. People said it smelled like burning plastic, all kinds of different stuff. It's really a weird story.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely strange. Now, here's what we know as of now. The gas cloud, as they described it, appeared Sunday, sending people fleeing from the beach and cliffs at Burling Gap, a popular coastal spot 60 miles south of London. There were lifeboats that were dispatched to help clear people from the beaches there. And Eastbourne District General Hospital said that it treated more than 130 people. So, I mean, this is no small event. The Sussex police said that injuries were mostly minor, though. Whatever it was, they said it, again, like Matt already reported, it smelled like burnt plastic. It hung about, didn't move yesterday because there was no wind, according to Bob Jeffrey of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution's Eastbourne Division. Now, pollution has been known to drift to Britain from industrial plants in France, but police said that wind direction made that unlikely in this case. We also have this report, however, from the Telegraph, Matt, where they said that an algal bloom in the channel might have been behind the mystery that drifted ashore and left about, now they're saying the total counts up to about 150 people needing hospital treatment, it's been suggested.
But nothing was overly serious, I don't believe. Nothing put anybody in critical condition, but they did all exhibit symptoms and inflict certain inflictions.
You know, here's the thing about this, and I'm not by any means, trying to say that people imagined something. That's not what I'm saying at all. But in conjunction with an unusual aroma, I do sometimes wonder, and I'm sure that some people actually were affected by something, but I wonder also about the psychosomatic aspect of this, where some people may think that they've been affected by something and they almost have imaginary symptoms. Now, clearly that's not the case with everybody. Okay. Again, a little bit more about what we know right now. The Meteorological Office weather forecaster, Jay Merrill, in the UK, said that a ship in the English Channel may have been responsible, but stressed that nothing conclusive had been proven yet. So a lot of people are looking at the channel right now. And while there's the algal bloom idea, then there's also the ship that was there in the channel. A toxicologist named John Hopkins said that the haze might have been photochemical smog caused by sunshine reacting with vehicle pollution. He said it's just a function that we've got too much traffic on the roads and too much sunshine, and that this combination could indeed prove to be very, well, disturbing for some people, fortunately not deadly. Emergency services at first pointed to a possible industrial leak again in northern France. That apparently, they say, is unlikely. Other suggestions, though, do include an industrial accident along the coast. There was a contaminated shipping tanker that they said might have released some substance that washed ashore. Now, Dr. Simon Boxall of the National Oceanography Center in Southampton said that if the reports from the public are to be relied on, it is weird that this quote-unquote cloud rolled in from the west. This is against the very light winds which should have driven in from the east, and this implies a waterborne cause. The conditions yesterday were ideal for the development of a toxic algal bloom. They said it was very calm, high light levels, and a period of moderate runoff inputting high levels of nutrients into the sea for the preceding weeks. All kinds of things that might attribute to this. But now the thing that we kind of have to remember here, there is something that happened a long time ago, okay? Well, not that long ago. 1952, really, we're talking about. There was a yellowish-black fog that descended on the city of London. And you can look this up. I mean, look up, like, the Great Smog of London, or the Big Smoke is kind of one of the nicknames for it. Look this up, because there were photographs of this. I mean, it was the thickest pea soup fog. In fact, that's why they call these things sometimes a pea super.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this mystery fog went for decades without being fully understood. Now, there was a study that appeared, I think it was just earlier this year, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and it suggested that there are indeed similar conditions that are conducive to dangerous, deadly fogs that can still occur today. That was the first thing that came to mind when I heard about people being affected down here on the coast by whatever this haze was. And Renyi Zhang of Texas A&M University co-authored the paper with a number of graduate students from China, California, Israel, and other locations. I'm going to skip ahead to what they reported, and here are the discoveries that they found. They said that people have known that sulfate was a big contributor to the fog, and sulfuric acid particles were formed from sulfur dioxide released by coal burning for residential use and power plants and other means. But how sulfur dioxide was turned into sulfuric acid in the atmosphere, and hence why some people, when they stepped outside, breathed this smog and then died in 1952, yeah, was unclear. Now, they said our results showed that this process was facilitated by nitrogen dioxide, another co-product of coal burning, and occurred initially on natural fog. They said another key aspect is the conversion of sulfur dioxide to sulfate, is that it produces acidic particles which subsequently inhibit the process. So natural fog contained larger particles of several tens of micrometers in size, and the acid formed with sufficiently dilution, or I'm sorry, the acid that was thereafter formed was diluted. So again, they said it was harder for this to evaporate thereafter, and it left these little particles of acid haze that covered the entire city. Literally, it was a deadly fog.
Yeah, it's I was reading about it earlier, and it said sunrise had burned off the fog, leaving concentrated acid droplets.
God,
which, I mean, that is terrifying.
Well, you know, again, and this is what's scary to me, is that there are people out there who continue to try and contest that the pollution that we put out into the atmosphere and onto the planet otherwise is affecting the climate. Guys, well, listen, as far back as 1952, there was fog in London that killed people.
Yeah.
Okay?
And you have to think that we are such a reactionary species that it wasn't until, so this happened, and then they immediately passed the Various Powers Act of 1954 and the Clean Air Acts of 1956 and 68.
I wonder why they named them that.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we do better at times, but we are very reactionary. We're not proactive in a lot of these respects. So I think there's a lot of ground we can gain in that regard.
Well, one would at least hope. And again, the message, I think, here is that when we see things like this happen, I think most often it is a combination of factors and things that have to be taken into consideration. So let's just be mindful as Team Civilization here. Note the history. Look at what's happening right now. I can't necessarily say that there is, or that that there is a causal relationship here. You know, causation doesn't necessarily mean correlation and whatnot, but I mean, again, they said that the conditions yesterday were ideal for the development of toxic Everything from an algal bloom to God knows what else. And we do need to be able to take into consideration the dangers afoot and what role we might play in all that. You know, Matt, again, I want to get into this story in the next hour. We got a few listener emails to get to also. But I want to talk primarily about, again, this idea, something that has long fascinated me. Feral humans. Could there be people out there who just live off the grid, or people who are deranged or have some sort of a mental problem? I mean, people who are, again, you know, maybe even born in the wild. There are a lot of different factors here, and a lot of people look at this as being purely an urban legend. There is, funny enough, we had Tiffany Mack on the program last week, you know, and Tiffany and I, we're naturally fascinated with all the different folklore and the mysteries and the things, not only about Kentucky, her home state, but, you know, really all over the place. We have long conversations about this kind of stuff, and frankly, she and I have experienced some really weird stuff ourselves. But in the book Weird Kentucky, you know, that series of, you know, the weird such and such, insert name of state here.
Yeah.
The Weird Kentucky book features three reports of alleged feral human sightings, and one of them occurred near Cloud Splitter Rock back in 1980. We're going to talk about that and what that has to do with one of the most peculiar newspaper items I've ever turned up that involves a really eerie incident that took place in 1917. That's going to be coming up in the next hour. Before we go to break, we got to take a moment here really, really quickly, again, to refer to our sponsors, friends of the program here. And one that you've certainly heard us talking about in the past is the Casper. That's right. Not the ghost. We're talking about all these wild men and mysteries and myths and things like that. Now, I'm not talking about the friendly ghost. I'm talking about the mattress here. You see, the secret to the Casper is the supportive memory foams that they use. Nothing ghostly about that, and it creates a sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. The coolest thing, though, I'll say about a Casper is that when they ship it to you, it comes in this little bitty box, and you move it into your house, and you're looking at it, and you're going, wow, what is in this box? I mean, I know there's supposed to be a mattress, but how do they fit a mattress inside a box that small? You open the box, you pull the mattress out, and once you break the air seal, I mean, this thing folds out, and it inflates to a full-size mattress. It is the coolest thing, and that's, I mean, one of my favorite things about the Casper is just seeing how it arrives, and then, boom, it's like a show when you take the thing out of the box. But they are actually an award-winning mattress with over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars. It's pretty safe to say by now, I think, that they're the internet's favorite mattress if you base that on what you see at their website and at Amazon.com and on Google and other reviews you're going to find. But the best part is you can try your future Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and they'll refund you for everything. So your future Casper mattress is designed and developed and assembled right here in the USA. Plus, you get free shipping and returns in the US and Canada. And right now, you can get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/TGR, where you're going to want to put in this offer code, TGR, just like the link. I'll give you that link again here in a moment. Just keep in mind, terms and conditions do apply. But that link again is Casper, CASPER.com/TGR, where you're going to enter that offer code TGR. Trust me, guys, it's a better way to sleep at night and the only way you'll ever want to sleep again. Casper.com/TGR. Use that offer code TGR, as in the Graylian Report, and get $50 off right now. I know you guys will appreciate that. Now, I just want to say, again, heading into the next hour, I don't want to say listener discretion is advised, because, I mean, it's a family-friendly show, but this is a really eerie subject to me. The idea of people living ferally, wild men running around out there in the remote wilds. Matt, we've had some of this stuff over there, at least the allegation that there were people living off the grid like this over in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. That's very near to here. And so this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart, but also a little eerie. And we'll delve into this when we return here on the Graylian Report.
is the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, our home on the web. Proud home of the Grailian Report, and soon to be also the home of our dear friends further south in Skeleton Studios, Expanded Perspectives. Really looking forward to having the boys join the fold here. Indeed, we have quite a great team of individuals that assist not only with this program, but really just the whole KGRA family. Good place to be, good times to live in, and so glad to have all you guys along here with us here as we pursue the mysteries of our existence. Again, I want to put out that hurricane update line. Anybody down there in the affected areas tonight, you're welcome to send along a text to us. And if you listen to the podcast later throughout the week, as this situation develops, we'd like to hear from you. Let us know that you're doing okay. That number is 828-367-7201. One more time, 828-367-7201. And if you enjoy this program, of course, we do advise for your benefit that you head over to GrailianReport.com/X. Consider signing up. We've had a lot of signups lately, and we want to get a few more because you're going to get additional weekly podcasts, monthly specials, and all kinds of stuff. From time to time, in fact, Cam and Kyle from Expanded Perspectives and I, we will team up and we will do a mishmash of our two programs where we all come together, put our powers together as one. Yeah. Because, you know, with our powers combined, we are Captain Hadel, I guess. Yeah, the true hero of the Hollow Earth. Matt, I think, is actually secretly Captain Hadel.
It works something like a Transformer, you know?
Sort of.
Yeah, something like that.
It's kind of weird. Weirder than a wild man. You know, here in a minute, I might have to ask Race Hobbs if he has ever seen a wild man. But first, I do want to get a few listener emails in here. Now, Paul writes, Micah, you know, love the shows. I totally forgot to send you this before you headed up to Nova Scotia recently, but I had a semi-famous relative up in Cape Breton. I wish I had provided this source prior to your trip. Perhaps if you ever return, this would be an interesting stop to see. Apparently, Angus McCaskill, frequently referred to as Giant McCaskill, was known as the world's largest true giant. In other words, he was of normal proportions. There were no growth abnormalities. Now, the 1981 Guinness Book of World Records lists Angus as the tallest natural giant who ever lived, the strongest man who ever lived, and the man having the largest chest measurements of any non-obese man. There's a giant McCaskill museum with a bunch of cool stuff to see in Englishtown, Canada. He says, forgive me as the source links may produce redundant information, but it's all worth the read. And he sends along the Wikipedia article for Angus McCaskill. That's M-A-C, Angus underscore M-A-C, A-S-K-I-L-L, McCaskill. That way you can look him up, ladies and gentlemen, at home. Truly interesting stuff, and he wanted to pass that along. P.S., where can I get or pay for some of the bumper music that you play on Grailian, especially some of Caleb's creations like the Jurassic Park 8-bit thing? I would greatly appreciate it. I'll try and see if we can figure out a way that we can get some of that stuff available online. Of course, I would refer people over to theclerkchronicles.com, which is Caleb's website, where you can see some of his art and also hear some more of his music. If you like the music you hear on the Grailian Report, theclerkchronicles.com, you're going to find a virtual treasure trove of what Caleb is up to. And I keep trying to get the little guy to come back on the show. He's always traveling these days, like me. He's got a different band that he's out there with right now. Grandfather's Cough Medicine, I think, is the name of the band. I still have not seen them yet. I hear they're really good, though.
I caught a little bit of a show one evening. It was good, yeah.
Yeah, I need to see it. It's bluegrass. It's kind of funny. I'm moving away from bluegrass, and Caleb, the techno musician, plays mandolin in a bluegrass band and travels all the time. Who knew? Who'd have thunk it? Who knows? Calvin writes, hey, Mike, a longtime listener here. Sometimes I can be seen in the chat room. And by the way, for those who may see him there, I don't know, Calvin, are you in there tonight, Matt? Psilocybe Whisperer, he might be in there.
I don't see him in here tonight, unfortunately.
I've seen him in there before, though. So anyway, he says, I'll keep this short and sweet, but I wanted to tell you about a sighting that I and my friends had Sunday night in Teleco Plains, Tennessee, before the Monday solar eclipse that had us wondering. He says, we were all laying down on blankets looking up at the sky at the campground we were staying at. We were specifically watching for iridium flares or any other kind of satellites. We saw a few iridium flares over the course of a few hours, and at one point, though we saw an extremely bright flash come from the opposite side of the sky the iridium flares were traveling from, when we looked, there was nothing there. But a split second later, the object flashed again, but not as bright as that first time. And then we started to track the object going across the sky and seemingly flashing at random. Now, the flashing didn't seem to be evenly spaced, and sometimes it would flash so faint you could barely see it, and other times the object would flash so bright nothing else was as bright in the sky. Between the flashes, though, we would totally lose sight of this thing. Also, it was moving extremely slowly compared to the iridium flares I'm used to seeing. Now, whatever it was appeared to be in orbit, but we have no way of knowing for sure if it was. We were talking about the thing the whole time we had it under sight, which was no less than 15 minutes. We have no clue what the thing was, but we also think from the random flashing and the degree of brightness that maybe it was a tumbling object in space, maybe some space junk catching the sun's rays just right or something similar. Whatever it was weird to us. I've never seen anything like it, and I was wondering what you think about this object as well. Hope this finds you well, and I'll sign out using my chat room name, Psilocybe Whisperer. P.S. Can I be the minister of psilocybin? Hey, you know what, Calvin? I say, so mote it be. He also says, P.S.S. Hubs, hubbo, hubs, hub, hub, hubs, hubbo. Yeah. See, Hobbs, I'm telling you, man, every day I get an email from somebody. Hobbs.
I just get tickled how people just embrace our banter before the show.
Hey, guess what? Hobbs.
Hubble, hubble, hubble.
The hobbits are out there.
The legend.
That's what I had some folks come up to me at dinner one time. I have to meet the legend of Hobbo. I just was floored.
The legend of Hobbo. Yeah. We like to have fun from time to time on the show, Hobbs. I actually tell you the truth. Now, you said, Race, where you were down in Natchez recently?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Natchez, Mississippi.
One of our listeners, Lauren, told me that that is her birthplace, that she is originally from there.
What a beautiful place she is from. I mean, it's a, especially, I was with, it was Robin and I and Warren and Courtney and their son. But it's, it's a very romantic place. Very, very romantic place. It's just an enchanting place with a huge volume of history. It would take the better part of a week to see all the wonderful sites and historical sites that are there. It's just, and it's just set right on the Mississippi River there. Beautiful place. Very beautiful.
Well, fortunately, I've got a TARDIS, so I think I'm going to have to head down to Natchez. We're going to trace the Natchez trace and go home the long way around. So, but speaking of my friend Lauren, by the way, so she writes into the program this week because she recently wanted a recommendation. Actually, I don't know if it was that she wanted the recommendation, but I made one nonetheless because she watched a film recently that is called The Town That Dreaded Sundown. Are you familiar with this, Matt?
Oh, I love that movie. Absolutely love that film.
Yeah, I like Flims too.
Yeah.
But so I told her, I said, well, if you liked that film, if you like Charles B. Pierce, you should watch the film The Legend of Boggy Creek. Now, Lauren had not seen The Legend of Boggy Creek. And so I recommended it to her, and she did as I recommended, and she and her family went and watched it that night. And she wrote a full review for me. And I told her, I said, since we're going to talk about wild men on the show, do you mind if I read the review that you sent? And I said, she said she graciously allows us to read this. So thank you, Lauren. But here's what she wrote along to us. She says, I usually take movie and TV show or music recommendations with a grain of salt, mostly because my tastes are so varied and weird. Hey, I know what you mean. That's why I recommended this film to her. And she says, I can't fit my likes into a specific genre or even a specific era. I like a little bit of everything, but finding those favorites can be a challenge. So I went into the Boggy Creek film with managed expectations. It's older, low-budget, docudrama, Southern Sasquatch thing. You might love it, you might hate it. She says, well, I loved it. Loved it. So here are the things that she says that she likes about this film. And again, Matt, you've seen The Legend of Boggy Creek, haven't you?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, all-time favorite of mine. She says, first of all, the atmosphere. I'm a sucker for movies that nail atmospheric elements, and this one absolutely did. Rural Arkansas isn't that far from me as the crow flies, and so the sights and sounds are familiar. The opening credits made me feel right at home, but also uneasy because it felt kind of, close to home. Now, the perfect execution continued with crackling fires, screaming babies, the gnat sound, the no-see-ums that you, I don't know if the no-see-ums are what really makes sounds. I think Lauren's probably right when she says gnats, but nonetheless, she says, whoever ran the boom mic on that project earned their paycheck. Then you had the narrator, Vern Stearman, Oh, was it Steinman? I'm not sure. I think that my my Google Doc here may have tried to do a grammar check on that. I hate when spell checks words that were
just ruins
spelled.
Everything. Yeah,
it really does. Yeah, but so she says Vern has one of those voices, as do you. Oh well, thank you very much. And it's just smooth and very easy to listen to. Despite the overwhelming tension in certain scenes, his voice was relaxing, and it felt like listening to my papaw spin a tale. I was completely engaged the second he started talking. He does have a great voice, the narrator of the film. The accents, speaking of voices, she says, oh my goodness, I get self-conscious with my heavy southern accent. Hold on, Lauren. Do you know who you're talking to here? Who do we know who has a southern accent, Matt?
Wendy said in the chat room a little bit ago, she was like, I used to think that Micah had a southern accent, a strong southern accent, and then I heard race.
I don't think my accent is very southern, Matt. I don't know. I think it's more interesting when I do an English accent. But you know what's funny is whenever...
I don't have a southern accent either, pal.
Oh, it's Don Ecker, ladies and gentlemen.
See, I have never thought I had a southern accent. And I was working at a call center several years ago and taking calls from New Jersey. And I answered the phone, just, good afternoon, thank you for calling. What can I help you with? And... this guy comes at me and just goes, wow, you're from the South, ain't you, boy? I was like, wow. Wait,
was he making fun of your
voice? Yeah, he was making fun of me. I was like, really? Is it?
I would have said, you got a problem with that, girl?
No, I would have said, do you have a problem with that? Do you?
Okay. Do you?
Yeah, so let's see here what Lauren had to say about the accent. So she said, a few of the characters had me thinking, am I that bad? Surely I don't sound that country. I don't think you do, Lauren. But I loved it. I can appreciate the casting of locals because nothing takes me out of the moment quicker than an actor delivering a horrible version of a southern accent. Exactly, like the guy that was criticizing Matt's obviously southern accent.
Yeah, I'm pretty backwoods with it.
You know? Yeah, I mean, you sound so southern, Matt. Really, so southern. Really. This is one of my all-time favorite books. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped ahead. Jude Law and Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil comes to mind. That's one of my all-time favorite books, and the casting of Jude Law and his horrible accent broke my heart. She says, you were absolutely right about the production, Micah. I had to keep reminding myself that this was shot in 1972 and on a very low budget. I didn't expect aerial shots on the creek snaking through the countryside. I also marked out for the freehand shaky shots from the booger's point of view. That's a good name for it. Call it a booger. I want from the booger of Boggy Creek from now on. We've redubbed this creature. Sorry, Lyle Blackburn. When Tiffany and I come up there to see you in Kentucky here in a couple of weeks, we're going to bring you a T-shirt. It's going to say the booger of Boggy Creek. This is going to happen. That's a common technique in scary movies, by the way. But back then, it looked out of place. But it's amazing. In an amazing way, it looked.
Booger.
Death blow.
Yeah. I think we can sign off now. That's exactly. Well, that's all from us. Yes.
That's all from the Graylian gang this week. The realism, based on actual accounts, yes, please. And she says, best of all, they kept the actual Bigfoot scene subtle. And I love that. It's like in Jaws, that ominous score paired with a shot of an open water scene is way more terrifying than actually watching Jaws take a bite out of a boat.
And hey, his name was Bruce. Okay,
let's go. The shark's name?
Well, that's what they called it on set, yeah.
Bruce?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Seeing the large, dark outline of Bruce looming in the woods, or briefly, wait, hold on. What's the shark doing out of the water? Yeah. Or briefly crossing a foggy back road, so unsettling.
The boogers in the
Lauren,
woods.
Lauren, I apologize.
Bruce is in the water.
We're really butchering your message here, Lauren. I'm sorry. Yeah, we're butchering your message. I also love the use of hunting dogs that wouldn't or couldn't track the monster. Very missing 411. Yeah, there was a bit of that, wasn't there? And finally, I love a good scare, and Boggy Creek delivered, without relying on CGI or jump scares or gore. Other than masks, the scariest element of a movie can have, in my opinion, is a booger that can't be killed with conventional methods. The fact that the fine folks of Falk put several rounds into the monster and he was unaffected, that scares me so much. Perfect. So great recommendation, not an easy feat with me in movies, and so thank you. And you're so welcome. So... and for those of you out there who have not seen the Beast of Boggy Creek, you definitely want to check that out. I think the whole thing's on YouTube, but, you know, it's well worth the buy if you just want to get a good DVD copy, too. And that's a great segue into our section for tonight's program, where we will be discussing Wild Men. Race, So you're up there from around the Ozarks. Have you ever heard any wild man stories up there that you haven't told me already?
No. No, it's just about me.
But I do know that Race is a mutual huge fan of the X-Files, and what I said to Mike on break, one of the things that got me so enthralled with the feral human, you know, theory or whatever, was the Jersey Devil episode very early on in the X-Files runtime. Do you remember that one, Hobbs?
I do, absolutely I do.
Yeah, it's great. Such a great episode.
Well, I don't remember that because I never watched X-Files, but I do remember the booger.
The Jersey booger.
That's right. Well, I want to point out, by the way, okay, so last week, Tiffany and I, we did a whole hour talking about some of the rural legends of Kentucky, but there was one that I forgot. And Tiffany, I know she's listening at home right now because she's breaking the code of conduct and texting me during the program here.
Unforgivable.
Unforgivable, Tiffany. Stop that. But, and watch, she's going to text in response because she knows she can.
She's a bad girl.
She is. Oh, she's bad, all right. She's as bad as a wild man. You wild girl. Now, there's a book by Jeffrey Scott Holland called Weird Kentucky. And this is in that, you know, the weird, and then insert the name of the state. I mean, this is a whole series that Mark Skruman and Mark Moran are the guys that kind of put this whole thing together. Greg Bishop, actually, I think, was one of the authors of the Weird California book.
Yeah.
So Jeffrey Scott Holland was the guy that put together the one on Weird Kentucky, and he has a very short section on feral humans. And I want to just share some of this here. So he says, the subject of feral humans brings another rather fascinating element to any discussion about Bigfoot. Some people feel that a certain percentage of Bigfoot sightings might actually have been of humans who have, for one reason or another, entered a wild animalistic state. Here are three cases of note. So the first one is dated December 24th, 1983, in Union County. Jan Thompson reported seeing a very tall, over 6 foot, naked man with unhealthy-looking pale skin and head of long flowing hair walking at night on Christmas Eve. My God, it was a Hadle. That's not Bigfoot, that is a Hadle. The person seemed to be in a completely feral state and had blood in its hair and on its hands and face, definitely a Hadle, because of its animalistic facial features and behavior, not to mention solid red glowing eyes, Hadle, Thompson was inclined to think of it more as a Bigfoot-like creature than a human being, especially since Bigfoot reports are common in Union County. What do you make of that? Now, I mean, here's the thing, though. Again, there are some who interpret Bigfoot as being purely myth and legend. I have wondered if there's anything more logical in terms of an explanation for Bigfoot. Could feral humans have something to do with it? Consider this case, this one from the summer of 1985 in Estill County, just 2 years later. After local residents began reporting a man-like figure prowling in the woods near their homes, Bigfoot rumors, as usual, began circulating like wildfire in the area. Police combed the wilderness and apprehended a man, a native of Irving, who had been on the missing persons list for quite some time. And according to the reports, he was naked but covered with mud and foliage to the extent that vines and moss and lichen were actually growing in his hair and on his body. He was in a completely animal-like state of mind, could not or would not speak English, and had to be forcibly subdued. He was then taken to Patty A. Clay Hospital in Richmond. There were no further reports on his recovery in local media. But the one that gets me is one that the author of this book, Jeffrey Scott Holland, reported having himself. This one occurred in the spring of 1990 in the Red River Gorge near Slade in Powell County. The author encountered face-to-face in the wilderness near Cloud Splitter Rock, an adult in his 30s, presumably. He was a Caucasian male walking in the woods, naked but covered with mud, leaves, and vines, which were matted into his hair and beard as well, giving him an almost absurd ZZ Top-turned Swamp Thing appearance. He walked with a hunched, ape-like gait. He spotted me, the author says, moments after I spotted him, and we stared at each other for what at the time felt like an eternity. Finally, he turned and fled. His eyes seemed to show some intelligence, but he was still extremely animal-like and seemingly unable to speak. I made no effort to follow him. I've heard similar stories over the years from locals in Slade about old mountain men who have lost their minds and are now living deep in the wilderness, reverted to an animal-like state. So those are the stories that he includes in the book, those three encounters of feral humans. Again, it's really weird, and I think what really kind of got me thinking about this was that perennial
case that occurred right over here across the mountain in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park back in the 1960s, the disappearance of the young boy Dennis Lloyd Martin. And coinciding with his disappearance that afternoon, Father's Day weekend, near Spence Field in the GSP. About an hour later, a man and his family, Harold Key, were hiking near Rowan's Creek, and as they head up into the forest, on the advice of a park ranger who said if you walk up that trail, you'll probably see some wildlife. They were looking for bears and whatever else they might get to see. And they said as they were walking up the trail, they hear a shrill and sickening scream and echoing from somewhere nearby. And then shortly after that, Harold's son gets his dad's attention and points up on the ridge above him and says, "Dad, look, there's a bear." But Harold said it was no bear. He said, and this is his exact description I'm going to quote for you here. "It was a dark-figured, rough-looking man. And we never got a really good look at him because he was behind like a laurel thicket, like he was down trying to keep from being able to be seen. And he said that he eventually finally took off so quick up the side of the mountain and he appeared to be carrying something over his shoulders. It might have been something red-colored. Only an hour before that, Dennis Lloyd Martin had vanished from Spence Field. He'd been wearing a red polo shirt." So when David Pilates went and interviewed him, you know, the author of the 411 books, Missing 411, he went and he interviewed, not Harold Key, I'm sorry, he interviewed Dwight McCarter, who had been a park ranger who had been part of the search there in the 1960s in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And he goes, he just did a cold call and went to Dwight's house. You got to keep in mind, David's a former detective himself, law enforcement. And so he goes up to McCarter's house, and McCarter and his sons are apparently working on a car out in front of the house. And he says, you know, "Dwight, my name's David," tells him who he is, where he's from, what he's doing, what he's researching. He says, "Can I just talk to you for a minute?" And he asked Dwight McCarter, he said, "You know, what do you think about that shrill, sickening scream? What do you think made the scream? Who or what screamed? Do you think that could have been a kid screaming, or do you think that something that loud could have been something else?" And he says, Dwight McCarter looked at the ground and goes, "Well, there were wild men living in the Smokies at that point." And he said, "Let me be clear. When I say wild men, I don't mean something crazy or mythological." He said, "I mean, there were men who had gone off the grid, who were living fairly in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park." He said that 1 year beforehand, up at Cataloochee, there had been a ranger that was attacked by one of these wild men. And that's why the year before, they had begun carrying weapons. The park rangers, many of them started carrying guns because one of their rangers had been attacked by a wild man they set up there. And that these guys were over there in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park at that time. And he says, "I wouldn't rule out the possibility that that dark-figured, rough-looking man that Harold Key and his family saw was one of these guys, you know, some crazy hobo living off the land out there in the park."
You know, and these stories are so amazing to me, but I think people, we always need to remember that there's so many different aspects to this kind of feral human, you know, narrative. I was doing a bit of research on this, and there are so many stories. A lot of them date back to the 1700s, that, as to be expected, there are very few from recent times, but some of the ones that stood out to me, we have a boy in Hungary who was nicknamed Steve of the Marsh. Are you familiar with this one?
I know about Steve of the Zisso. I don't know about Steve of the Marsh.
So according to documents, this is 1749, stored at the Catholic parish of Capovar. An abandoned child was once found in a marshy lakeside forest by two fishermen. He was brought to the town, where he was christened and received the name Stephen. The local governor took him into his castle and tried to raise him up, but the boy eventually escaped and ran back to the forest. Later, numerous folktales developed around his character, depicting him as a half-fish, half-human creature.
Okay, now that's
interesting.
Who lived
in the nearby lake.
Now, hold on, that's interesting, because again, you have a story of a legitimate feral human,
yeah,
around which a myth of a more human-animal hybrid-esque creature.
Almost cryptozoology evolves out of it.
Yeah. I tell you, see, there's a part of me that's wondered if at the heart of some of the Bigfoot stuff isn't the very real possibility that there are some, you know, contingencies of feral humans, either in pockets or just lone wolf crazies out there, that contribute to some of these reports, like what we saw in Kentucky.
Yeah. Well, the other ones that grabbed me, and this one's a little bit not really feral, I guess, in the sense that we would typically think of it. Casper Hauser which I don't know if you're familiar with this, but one of our mutual favorite filmmakers, Werner Herzog, made a film about Kaspar Hauser, who was said to be this boy who was kept in a dungeon for 16 years and never let out or anything, and was reintroduced to life randomly, like not by his captors or anything. He was just found wandering through, I believe it was Nuremberg. And really interesting story. I haven't seen the film yet, but I really want to.
Oh, me too.
Herzog.
You know? Oh, yeah, I love his films.
There was also Ramachandra in the 1970s and 80s. He was first reported in 1973 in the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh at roughly 12 years old and as living an amphibian lifestyle in the Kuano River. He was rescued in 1979 and taken to a nearby village. He only partly adapted to a conventional lifestyle, still preferring raw food, walking with an awkward gait, and spending most of his time alone in nearby rivers and streams. He died in 1982 after approaching a woman who was frightened by him and who badly scalded him with boiling water.
My gosh.
Yeah. There were other ones that I found. There was a story from actually 2012. That's the most recent one I see here. From India, and a young girl apparently went missing in a jungle at age 4 and didn't return until 38 years later in 2012.
But she actually resurfaced.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. There was only one story I see about a girl who was claimed to be a feral child. It's the only case of a child having survived 10 years in the forests. Now, this is in France, Champagne, France, in 1721 to 1731, and the only feral child who succeeded in a complete intellectual rehabilitation. She learned to read and write, and according to a biographer, she was 19 years old when she was captured, learned to read and write, and died at the age of 63. So she reintegrated into society in this way. It's so enthralling, what be it either by captivity, in the case we see of Kaspar Hauser, which is obviously incredibly depressing, and just how could somebody do that to a child?
Sure, of
and
course.
Then you have to wonder how some of these kids even wound up out in forests and jungles in the first place.
Real life, you know? Mowglis,
yeah.
In antiquity, we used to hear of them referred to, of course, in reference to that Jungle Book character. Well, now, when we come back, I don't know that this is necessarily a wild man. This might just be a crazy person. Although I suspect that there's more to what you're about to hear than purely urban legend. And again, parts of this story are just downright eerie, ultimately weird. So pour yourself another drink, dim the lights a little bit, and ease back into your chair. When we come back, I'm going to tell you one of the creepiest stories about an alleged wild man that I've ever come across when we return here on the Graylian Report. The churning noise of the inner earth enters your eardrums, and we gather together here around the campfire of the mind. It is the Graylian Report, and in this next segment, we're going to be talking about something that is, again, really eerie. And I've often said this before on the show, that when we talk about all the alleged monsters and creatures and things out there, strange things no sane God would allow, the scariest one is the one that walks on two legs. Now, it was June 1917, and a fella with an unusual name, Harry Quackenbush, and his seven friends were walking along. It was a state holiday in honor of, well, I guess something that people still celebrated back then, Voter Registration Day. They decided to go canoeing on the Hackensack River. So here's Mr. Quackenbush on the Hackensack River, where he and his company spent the day paddling upriver, and it was late by the time they came back. It must have been well after midnight, he said, when we dropped three of the group off at their home. Harry would tell the Bergen Record 18 years later, remembering this incident in an article that was published in 1935. Now, he and the remaining four, there was a male friend and then three females, they were walking along to the trolley terminal at Zabriskie's Pond, where Main Street starts. And Harry remembered there was a full moon that night. He said it was shining bright and full, and the roads were as clear as daylight ahead of us. And as the friends walked along, they were approaching the railroad crossing at New Bridge Road when they saw something odd. It was a man, Harry said. But he was huge, massive, and he was naked and white. But the whiteness was sort of dulled by something. That's his actual quote from the 1935 article. I couldn't make out just what. And he said, despite the alarming physical appearance of this large, naked man, Harry didn't tell his friends to run back the way that they came. Instead, they continued on their path until they too saw what was going on and slowed their pace about a half block back. He wanted to make sure that they'd seen this, almost as if to make sure he wasn't crazy himself. And it was at that moment when this strange man suddenly crouched on all fours and, like a big animal, galloped off through the high grass along the edge of the road, along the railroad tracks, on all fours. Well, the group, in order to get home, had to continue on in that same direction, and although they were frightened by what they saw, they continue on in the same direction that the large, naked, very pale man galloped away on all fours. Yeah, sounds a lot like a Hadal. And he says as they continued forward past the railroad tracks, they passed an oil-filled barrel that was sunk in the ground. Now, that might sound strange, but back in those days, it was pretty common along the railroads that they would sink these barrels into the ground so that they wouldn't roll away, and then they would fill them with oil, because that way, if a train had to stop along that portion of the track, they would have lubrication that they could use right there, and they could lube portions of the engine and whatnot. Which is used for all different kind of mechanical features. And so it was common to find these oil-filled barrels, and there was one right there by the railroad tracks. But here, as they came upon it, they heard splashing. And Harry and his friends looked down toward the barrel, and they saw within the barrel was the man, up to his neck, his hands grasping the outer edge, and he was moving around inside the oil. So they didn't want to take their eyes off the man, lest he leap from his greasy little bath at them, and so they walked backward until they came into a bend in the road, and when they could no longer see this oily devil, they took off running to the trolley terminal. Unfortunately, he didn't seem to pursue them. They get back safely. And there, even at this late hour, the conductor was on duty, and they told him. They said, look, there's a man over there. This guy's running around naked, scared the daylights out of us, and now he's splashing around in one of those oil barrels over there off the side of the track. And the conductor tells him, yeah, we know. That's Oily Oliver. He apparently recognized this character, and they said, yeah, we know about Oily Oliver around here. And it was recently reported in Weird New Jersey Magazine, this weird story about Oily Oliver. And the article reads, naked bearded men covered in railroad track oil aren't something you see often, even nowadays. Boy, that's the understatement of the century, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, circa 1917, this had to have been quite disturbing to the youthful minds of the group. Never mind that the conductor and the motorman on the trolley told them that they would contact the police about their strange sighting. But Mr. Quackenbush left the home with three male friends, a shotgun, and flashlights, and drove off to where Oily Oliver had last been seen splashing around to further investigate. Now, to the Oily One's credit, he was no longer there, but he left tracks that the men used to follow him for a good 4 hours along the Kirkenkimack Road up to the river edge, in a few empty houseboats along the river, and up the railroad tracks to New Milford. Their pursuit was stopped by armed guards at the Hackensack Water Company plant, who told them they, too, had seen Oily Oliver running around. That moonlit June night was Mr. Quackenbush's first and only experience with the so-called phantom nudist Oily Oliver, but he later recounted that the police had already unsuccessfully chased after Oliver along the railroad tracks in Hackensack, North Hackensack, near Fairmount, Newbridge, River Edge, New Milford, and Oradell. In 1962, the Bergen Record published a story that said that there were dozens of Oily Oliver encounters reported around that time, and that this Oliver character, quote, chose sunken oil barrels along the railroad tracks here for nocturnal baths. When the police found his greasy footprints and gave chase, Oliver would pop into different barrels along the tracks to hide. It was common in those days for the railroads to leave these sunken barrels of oil along the tracks. Again, that helped control weeds, and of course they'd also use it for fixing the trains. It may have also provided Oliver with a way to keep the bugs from biting his exposed skin. Now, Mr. Quackenbush also mentioned that a woman who lived near the tracks saw Oliver one night while she was entertaining friends, and it was assumed that this might have been the same woman who, in other newspaper recountings from that time, noted being a bit excitable and lonely, and was also said to have claimed that Oliver wiped himself clean with a line of full laundry she'd hung out to dry one evening. While Oliver never attacked anyone, they say that in 1962, a couple of women did report that women kept their children off the street and doors normally open during the warm summer months were bolted. The Bergen Record brought Oily Oliver to the forefront again as late as 1969, decades after that first encounter, when a social group called the Society of Fairmount Friends announced the formation of a committee that would collect, quote, all known accounts of his appearance. The committee's chairman, Edgar Simonson, said his sister had seen Oliver. She and a girlfriend were decorating graves in the Hackensack Cemetery when they saw a naked man covered with oil crawling in the undergrowth. The girls dropped their bouquets and ran screaming home, as any sane person would if they saw a naked, oily man crawling through the undergrowth in a graveyard. The date for this encounter was not given, but Simonson did say all the sightings provided the same description of Oliver, a powerfully built man crouching on all fours with oil dripping from a ragged beard. The Society of Fairmount Friends no longer seems to exist, possibly dying out with its members, so it isn't known if the stories were ever compiled in one piece. The Bergen County Historical Society, on the other hand, had no information on the existence of such a record when they were contacted in April of 2009. Apparently, only one story about Oily Oliver was previously published in Weird New Jersey magazine. That was from Babbitt Smith, who likely read the newspaper accounts when they were published in 1969 and went with her friends to check the location out. They must have been looking for a ghost, since Oily Oliver would have had to have found the petroleum fountain of youth to still be alive and running naked and Hackensack at that time, but they didn't see anything. In 2008, Mrs. Smith would participate in an investigation in the New Milford plant on the Hackensack Water Company, as reported in the South Burnett by Jim Beckerman, who also kindly shared his source materials. But again, no Oily Oliver appearances occurred. So the question is, who was this guy? There were a lot of theories about who this fellow might have been. A leading theory was that he was a man named Samuel Snyder. And in fact, the 1935 article that appeared in the Bergen Record showed a photograph of Snyder. He was a filthy man. He had matted hair, an unkempt beard. And the caption below the photo makes note of his 2.5-inch-long fingernails. What they say about Snyder was that he was arrested in March of 1921 after living in the Paramus Woods nearby, quote, like a hunted animal, where he snatched food now and again from the porch of his father's home. He was still living at the state asylum at Morris Plains when the article was written, which obviously seems to infer that he was a person who suffered some mental issue and had at one time lived feral in the forest, stealing food from his father's front porch. So that was a leading theory about who Oily Oliver might have been. Could it indeed have been an actual feral human, and perhaps even a person who suffered some mental issue that explained the behavior? And on moonlit nights after midnight, he would run around and frighten people, running naked in the dark and hiding in barrels of oil. I don't know. It's just really, really creepy. I hope nobody else ever runs into Oily Oliver. But I will mention this, that there's a distinct similarity between this story and something that you hear about in Malay cultures. There's a whole tradition in Indonesia and other places about what are called grease devils. And the idea of a grease devil, it's sort of a phantom attacker that runs around, but it's a man who covers himself in grease, and that way he's slippery and he can't be apprehended very easily. And so I wondered the same thing about Oily Oliver. Could it also have been that this guy was just some sort of a, you know, a filthy-minded ne'er-do-well who was running around trying to scare people or something, and that perhaps bathing in the oil was a way for him to literally evade capture?
Well, there was even the theory I read that some people thought that Oily Oliver was apparently a local reverend or a reverend's son who would just go nuts on a full moon and go around doing this stuff. I mean, that seems more far-fetched than the story of the guy put in the mental institution, but that's a pretty tweaked little narrative for it.
Oh, it absolutely is. Any way that you look at it, what's really weird is the fact that, I mean, there do seem to be some legitimate accounts of, for the existence of Oily Oliver. I mean, it very well could have just been a made-up story that a lot of people participated in. But, I mean, when you have something like this where a lot of people report seeing it, and this isn't some cryptozoological mystery. I mean, they're saying a large, powerfully built, bearded, naked man covered in oil, which, again, to me is even creepier than a mystery beast, because it's more likely there was actually some idiot running around doing this.
Well, our good friend John in the chat room just sent along a story that he recalled, the legend of the greasy man from Mississippi.
And this is
this is absolutely the same thing. It says this nefarious entity pictured by poor William as a naked, skinny white dude, pale as a possum's face, slinking in and out of reality, covered in translucent grease, grinning sardonically from the recesses of a room shrouded in darkness with wooden walls as a backdrop, would make you yearn for morning when light would filter through curtain cracks, showering a dimly lit room with dust particles, waltzing like fruit flies above an overly ripe banana.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It had to be Mississippi, of all places.
Of course, right?
Well, I tell you, sometimes I don't know what to make of some of these stories. It's obviously pretty clear that there may be true events that sometimes inspire urban legends. Whether or not the idea of a feral human or several of them running around could explain the entirety of the Bigfoot mythos, you know, I think that that's a bit of a stretch. And at times I go back and forth. I mean, what does this idea of the wild person represent in our myth and our culture? I mean, again, in the British Isles, we had the Woodwoses. In China, there was the story of the Yeren, the Yahoo in Australia, the Almasti in Russia. And in various iterations, these things are more ape-like or Bigfoot kind of creatures. And in some situations, they're just essentially wild people. A lot of the early Bigfoot reports from the last few centuries, in fact, described something, and that's what's interesting, the early Bigfoot reports often describe these more as being wild men rather than as being beast-like. So I wonder sometimes, where do we draw the line? When is something more animal-like and less human, or vice versa? When is something more human than animal? I think if it walks on two legs, it has a generally anthropomorphic shape, and it seems to have characteristics of behavior that are, even if feral in nature, are similar enough to humans, I think we're talking about something that is more man-like than animal-like.
Well, and we have to remember, though, the ability of the human psyche to, you know, exaggerate events and features and things like that, especially when confronted with this kind of turbulent event. Seeing a feral human's not something you see every day, so of course he has to be 10 feet tall and have 2-foot-long fingernails and growl at you.
Absolutely. Larger than life. And equally frightening. So, I'm sure that Oily Oliver's going to haunt everybody's dreams tonight. Fortunately, again, Oliver's probably long gone by now, and that's if there's truth to that peculiar little New Jersey urban legend. We'll wrap things up on the other side of this break when we return here on the Graylian Report. Mountains of Appalachia or the dark hollows below
It is the Graylian Report wrapping up this week's edition of the podcast. Thank you always for being a part of what we do every week and supporting our ongoing efforts to thrill, enlighten, amaze, and at times terrify. And I think that I'm already getting called on the carpet here, Matt, because we've terrified everybody with the story of Oily Oliver. I knew it would have that kind of an effect. But, you know, you made the interesting comparison during the break there. And we got to chat about this. We only got like a couple of minutes here. Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
Yes. Yeah. This is a character that has plagued me since I was probably 3 or 4 years old.
So tell him why.
Okay, so very early on in my childhood, I had Fisher-Price, my first record player. And you could go out and buy these books that were, you know, picture books from, I had like Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that kind of stuff. You put on the record, and it'd have sound clips from the movie, and then somebody would read the book to you. Well, I had The Hobbit from the Rankin-Bass Hobbit cartoon made in the 70s. Which was one of my favorite films. But the part with Gollum, it scared me to death when I was a small child. And I would have to leave the room anytime that scene came on the film or that part came on the record player. Just hearing his voice was so horrifying to me. And it's a fascination with that character that I've had all the way up through adulthood. I, you know, the introduction of the Peter Jackson films kind of reinvigorated it for me and further developed what I think is the most interesting part of Gollum, and, you know, I think can be ascribed to this the mythos or the theory of feral humans, and that is that we as human beings, we do so much to insulate ourselves from our animal urges. We have our cell phones, we have fridges full of food, you know, we don't have to go hunt and with our bare hands or anything. But the idea of Gollum being sent so far from a civilized person all the way down to a base level creature living in a cave, grabbing fish out of a lake in a mountain, then murdering anything that comes in there and eating them just because of his sick, twisted obsession with this one thing he found, the One Ring. We as human beings are only one step removed from our most animalistic urges. And that, I think, is one of the most horrifying parts about that narrative.
It certainly is, you know, and I think we could basically say that Gollum was a Heidel. Travel with me as we enter the inner earth.
Oh, my precious. Where is it? Where is it, my precious? Oh, Matt, does the kind-eyed one have it? Reverend has my precious. He will answer riddles for me. You will answer riddle.
Speak up, Matt. He's asking you a question.
Okay, I'll answer riddles.
First riddle. What is your name?
The Reverend.
What is your quest?
I seek the Grail.
Grail is not my precious. What is your favorite color?
Blue. No, red.
Well, that went well, I guess.
Sorry about that. Can't believe I got that one wrong.
Last time we invite Matt to play with Gollum. Ever. Oh, boy. Got to have a little fun with it, right? Hobo, thank you, buddy. I love you.
I love you, and I love all the Graylians. I love Matt, and thank you all for having me here once again this week.
Our pleasure. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Racing Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrail, Tiffany Mack, Matthew and I, and Gollum, we bid you adieu, my friends, until next time. Wherever you are, stay safe out there. Again, if you are in the area affected by Hurricane Harvey, drop us a line and let us know that you're okay out there. And until next time, my friends, as always, stay strange. We'll catch you on the wild side. We'll be right back.
listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.